This week on Startup Security Weekly, William Lin from Trident Capital Cybersecurity will be joining us. Very special in-studio guest, Mr. John Strand, who's here from yesterday's shenanigans, is going to sit in on Startup Security Weekly as well in our security news for startups. Security startup StackPath buys again. Five VCs are bullish about this year's outlook for startups. Security chatbot startup Demisto raises $20 million, and so much more. So stay tuned for this edition of Startup Security Weekly. This is a Security Weekly production.
To you by gain control of cyber risk with Tenable.io, the first vulnerability management platform built for today's elastic assets like cloud, containers, and web apps. Discover a fresh asset-based approach that prioritizes vulnerabilities while seamlessly integrating into your environment. Improve ROI with the first elastic licensing approach based on assets, not IP addresses. Tenable.io delivers the data and context you need to secure your elastic attack surface. Start your free Tenable.io trial by visiting Tenable.io. IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Access over 2,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content live and on-demand via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, or your mobile device. IT Pro TV's premium membership grants access to all courses, transcripts, virtual machine labs, and Transcender practice exams. Corporate and group pricing are available. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, visit itpro.tv/startupsecurity and use the code SS30. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending these assets? Have you penetration tested them? Start 2017 by taking a proactive approach to your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting@blackhillsinfosec.com to see how they can help you sleep better at night.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Startup Security Weekly. This is episode 26. It is indeed February 10th, 2017. I'm your host, Paul Asadorian, broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in very snowy Rhode Island, on the lines via Skype from a not-so-snowy beach in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Mr. Michael Santarcangelo. Michael, welcome to the show.
It's always good to be with you guys, and I'm excited John's with us this week. That's a blast.
Yeah. And sitting right here next to me is none other than John Strand, my partner in crime, as it were, for a lot of things that we can talk about and some things we can't.
Sitting here having some scotch, I'm wondering, why did I even leave yesterday?
Yeah. Maybe I didn't. It is past noon, actually, which is kind of...
Bloody Mary's before noon, scotch afternoon.
I'm still working on... Did you finish your Bloody Mary already?
I did.
Oh, okay. Well, then I got some catching up to do. right before I get caught up with the drinking shenanigans, a couple of quick announcements. IT Pro TV courses now include Cybersecurity Analyst Plus, CCNA Cyber Ops, ITIL Operations Support and Analysis, Penetration Testing, Networking Plus, and Ethical Hacking V9. IT Pro is introducing a new membership level soon. All current premium members will be granted the highest membership level available. So sign up today at itpro.tv/startupsecurity and use the code SS30 and save 30% off for life. InfoSec World 2017 conference is being held on April 3rd through the 5th even at the Omni Orlando Resort at Champions Gate in Orlando, Florida. Security Weekly listeners receive 10% off the conference when using the discount code OS17-SW. Talks will be done by none other than Kevin Johnson, Rich Mogul, Cory Doctorow, and more. Visit InfoSecWorld.misty.com and register today.
That is a hell of a lineup, too.
It is, yes. That's just a sample, too. The 10th anniversary of Source Boston is being held this April. and including training sessions on April 24th through the 25th and conference talks 26th through the 27th featuring awesome speakers from the security community. Events will take place in Boston at the Courtyard Marriott downtown, and Security Weekly listeners get 100% discount on either training or conference passes when using the discount code Security Weekly. Register now, because conference tickets are prices are just going to go up. So visit sourceconference.com today to find out more information. If you didn't vote for us, or you did vote for us, or you didn't vote, or whatever, it's too late because that ship has sailed. We'll see where we stand with the 2017 RSA Social Security Awards Best Security Podcast voting. Now I'd like to turn over to Michael Santarcangelo to introduce our very special guest for today's show.
Thank you, Paul. I'm actually excited. One of the things we promised you that we would do this year is we're going to keep reaching out and bringing in different voices and different perspectives. And we've been doing that, and the feedback's been great. And we're going to keep responding to that. So this is part of that. And today we've got William Lin. I've known him as Will. I hope I'm not disparaging him that way. And they just announced this week that Trident Capital Cybersecurity Fund. And there's a lot of excitement and a lot of news around that. And Will's here to talk with us today about that perspective. He's going to tell us about the fund, what the fundraising process is like from his side. We're talking about deals and what that's like, all sorts of fun stuff. So, Will, you and I have been talking now for a little bit. I'm so excited you're here. Congratulations on the launch this week, and welcome to Startup Security Weekly.
Thank you, guys. I'm pleasure to be here. I've been listening to you guys for a while since the beginning, and it's been pretty exciting. So thanks for the opportunity.
That's excellent. This show hasn't been around that long, so we're happy that you found us, especially someone in your position, Will. So how did you come to work for Trident Capital and do investing for them?
Yeah. So I've been with Trident Capital for about 5 years, and I started in investment banking out of college. So for you guys that know about investment banking is basically they just grind you as hard as they can out of college because you just came out, and they force you to work, 80 to 100 hours a week just doing models and pitches and decks. But before investment banking in college and before that, I've always had a big interest in cybersecurity and computers and sort of the underbelly of the internet, because back then, we didn't have Netflix and Spotify and all those different places. So I actually did in college a study for Microsoft about student piracy, why it happened. And, I've been involved in Bitcoin and all those different pieces. So all that came together. So after investment banking, I joined Trident Capital, and I've been here for about 5 years.
And now, when did you start investing in cybersecurity companies?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, 5 years ago, I started doing cybersecurity, but I also did fintech and I also did enterprise software companies. About 2 or 3 years ago, I started really focusing on cybersecurity because it was sort of a passion and an interest. And during the time, these 5 years, I've worked with about 10 cybersecurity companies and I've deployed $60 million. Five of those investments actually happened last year. While we were fundraising, we also made investments as well. And of those five, I'm on the board for three of them.
Okay, so which ones are you on the board for?
So the company called Bayshore Networks, they're based out in Maryland. They are focused on industrial IoT security.
Nice.
There's another one called... Yeah, awesome. I'm glad. There's another one called 4IQ. They are originally based out in Spain, and we helped them move over to the U.S. They're focused on the deep and dark web, the intel coming from
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them. Yep.
Awesome. And then the last one is a company called ID Experts. ID Experts is not as well known. They're based on Portland. What they do is they're sort of like LifeLock, but for the enterprise. So they're still serving the same customers in terms of the consumer, but the buyer is the enterprise. So for instance, like Target or Home Depot or all those different breaches, after the event happens, they have to remediate. They have to bring in someone to fix the IT, but also fix the privacy issues as well. And so that's what ID Experts does.
Interesting. And is that something that companies that get breached like voluntarily provide their employees to protect their employees' kind of personal privacy? Or is that something that's like a regulatory kind of thing? Because I know when you're investing, right, there's a big difference between like a company could want to buy your product and a company that is forced by regulation to implement some kind of solution for that problem.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Right now, it's voluntary, but they're doing it because of regulatory type reasons. Mm. So it's not, there isn't a mandate or anything like that that's forcing them to forcing customers to pay for or to subscribe to something like ID Experts. But they do it because they care about their customers. And, you know, this is typically the more important stuff, right? So if they lose your health, medical health record, that includes usually your address, your name, social security number, all of the ways that people can truly take over your identity. Versus something like, you know, LinkedIn, Yahoo, where they lose their username and password, there's a lot less to protect because it's a username and password. You know, someone can use that to get into your other accounts and get the ultimately more sensitive data, but it's not as direct. So there's no, you know, no specific reason to do it at those points.
All right, so
go ahead, Michael. Yeah, I was just going to turn it over to you.
so here's the thing that I'm kind of curious about. So talk us through this. So you've been in investment banking, you've been with Trident Capital for 5 years, you're already investing in security companies. So talk us through then the decision to launch a cybersecurity only fund, and then what goes into that? Like, why not just keep doing it from Trident Capital? Why do Trident Capital cybersecurity? What's the distinction? What's the benefit? Clue us into how that goes.
Yeah, definitely. So Trident Capital has been around for about 23 years, and in that time, they raised 7 funds. You know, you can differentiate between a really early fund and a long, long late-stage fund based on how many funds they've raised. Most firms, you know, they raise about 3, and then they'll move on to something else. After we raised our 7th fund and we finished investing it, we were thinking, okay, do we want to raise Fund 8, or do we want to, you know, re-examine? And we re-examined, we looked at our previous results, we looked at our expertise, and we looked at our interests, and we realized, hey, it makes more sense instead of raising Fund 8, let's raise 2 new funds. And so one of those 2 new funds was the fund I'm a part of. It's a venture capital firm that's focused exclusively on cybersecurity. The partners on the fund, they've been focused on cybersecurity since, you know, the days of the internet. Collectively, we've made 30 cybersecurity investments. We've exited 16, and we've made a lot of money for our investors. So because of that, we decided, okay, well, now's the time to do a cybersecurity-focused fund. And, you know, now that we've raised the fund and we've thought about it quite a bit, there's some really interesting things that we can do with a cybersecurity-only fund. So, for instance, a $300 million amount is, you know, it's a benchmark amount for a new firm. A new firm usually raises about $150 for their very first fund, and we were able to raise $300. And specifically within only cybersecurity, it means we can do at least, you know, 18 companies only in cybersecurity, and they'll all have the opportunity to work together and have more context. And
all right, so that's interesting. Yeah. So when you raise a fund like this, do you set a time frame by which you're going to invest in the companies? Like, so now, do you have a goal of how many of those 18 companies you'd like to get funded in the next? Like, how do you look at it that way when you're setting up the fund?
So, you know, venture capital has been around for a long time, and so there are lots of different steps to it. And one of them is there's an investing period, and then there's also a selling period. So a typical fund is about 10 years long. The first 5 years is meant for investing, and the second 5 years is meant for, you know, the company to gradually exit. So for us, we have a set timeline that's, you know, industry standard of 5 years. But for us, you know, for the main driver of making investments is mostly from, number one, capacity of the partners. How many deals can they do per year while also managing their current deals? And then number two, you know, how quickly do we want to deploy capital?
Well, what's the exit strategies? in other words, I think of them as like, you know, getting bought going public, but do also like some just make enough money to pay back the investors and then give some kind of residual? Like, how does it work with the exit strategies for the companies you invest in?
Yeah, definitely. So within cybersecurity, as you guys probably already know, majority of exits are M&A. Those are just a very clearer exit strategy because a lot of public companies nowadays, they don't want to hit their R&D budget with more capital and decrease their profits. And so instead of doing that, they want to buy companies that are already generating cash or profit. And that's within cybersecurity specifically, that's it's even more exaggerated where there's more M&A exits. IPOs are also really amazing. Those usually come with every technology shift, right? So when we move from mainframe to personal computing to mobile to IoT to cloud, all those different things usually come with a new platform and that usually comes with a new public company. But for us, you know, we're very realistic, right? We're going to make 18 plus investments in cybersecurity. Not all of them are going to be platform companies. And that's just a key difference between a cybersecurity-focused fund versus a generalist fund that also does cybersecurity, right? When you have the opportunity to make only two or three investments or less within your fund, you usually want them to be IPO candidates, right? You want them to exit. You want to be very, very public. And you want it to be a career-defining moment for everyone. For us, we're more focused on how do we return capital to our LPs, because those are our ultimate customers. And then also, how do we make sure that all of our entrepreneurs that we work with are happy at the end of the day, right? As you guys, as Michael mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of companies go out of business and they return nothing to both entrepreneurs as well as investors. And for us, we're focused on maintaining a low, making sure that doesn't happen very often. And luckily, in our track record, that hasn't happened very often.
Well, so that leads me to a question. So when I was listening to you talk about like an M&A, maybe even being favoring that a little bit over, you know, Paul, we've been talking over the last couple of weeks about, you know, as a startup, especially in the security space, that's a very likely outcome for you. Then when you're running a fund, is there – and I'm going to look at this from two directions. Is there an advantage, and do you need to then maintain good corporate, like Fortune 500 relationships to both understand their problems so you know where to go invest, and then to help connect these people for traction and then say, you know, by the way, I've got this company. You guys can buy them. I mean, like, where do you fit into that model of it? And I'm okay if this is fund specific, because I'm just trying to understand some of this a little bit better.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, for us, we have been investing for such a long time. And when we decided to start the fund, we realized, okay, we have all these friends that we talk to and we ask for help and they're happy to help us as well. Why don't we create relationships? So we actually created advisory council. There's 47 people on there. And a lot of those people are customers or they're entrepreneurs or they're industry executives in some way. For instance, you know, the former head of the NSA, Keith Alexander, is an advisor for us as well. And so those different pieces allows us to add value to our companies. And, you know, one of the great things about having a cybersecurity focused fund is sometimes things happen by random, right? Like you talk to someone random and all of a sudden there's a connection and it feels great. When you're only focused on cybersecurity and you're doing it for all your companies and talking to all these different customers and executives, those opportunities come together a lot more quickly. So, you know, that's just one of the things that we try to make happen. And so, yes, we are very, very connected to the acquirers. We're very, very connected to the customers. And then, of course, we have to be connected to the entrepreneurs as well.
And in a lot of ways, doesn't that actually seem like that's your major role? You're a facilitator and you're a connector between different people and different organizations, kind of helping those organizations along their path.
That's right. Exactly. And so, you know, there's so many different paths. You know, when you're an early stage company, there's a very, very different path from when you're a late stage company. And a key element is helping these companies go on the right path and helping them add people to help them move towards that right path
I have a question along those lines, Will. It's one that I believe I've asked on the show and I've spoken with mutual friends of ours about this. So you have a company that they solve kind of a small-ish kind of problem, right? But they do it really well in a really innovative way. And they're making inroads into the market. And they come to this crossroads pretty early on, and maybe they make a decision to change down the road. But, you know, they can either integrate with everyone, so everyone can share their data, so everyone needs their data because they get collected this data, let's say, in a very innovative way, or they can become the platform and grow and branch out and become the place where people go to get that information. How do you advise companies on their path, right? Are we going to be something small that people essentially OEM, or are we going to grow and off of our original innovative idea and become a much larger platform that basically everyone's got to buy, right? Like, how do you guide companies like that? I think it's one of the hardest things that I've been dealing with lately, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think that is a question that we've thought about a lot, and we actually have a plan for each. So for instance, within our $300 million fund, we have three buckets that we sort of view investments. So there is the point solution, which is sort of what you described. Right? They solve a very specific problem, and they do it extremely well. There is a platform where they solve multiple solutions with a lot of different features, and they integrate with a lot of different places. And then lastly, there's a company called Growth Equity Companies. Growth equity is defined by us, and everyone defines it a little bit differently, as companies where by, you know, sort of how John mentioned it, by luck, in before the interview, by luck, they're able to get to a $10 million revenue. And they don't know, you know, they just want more help, right? They decide, okay, reached this point. Let's do more. So in terms of the between point solution and platform, I think the key thing is a lot of different pieces. So market, the customers, how much ASP are they able to get? So average selling price. If the company is solving such a gigantic problem, and they're able to net a higher ASP, that's sort of more suggests that it's a platform company. On top of that, there's also what the customers view, right? Do the customers trust this company for that one company to be able to integrate with all these different products and create that platform solution? And then lastly, there's a market that they're selling to. So for instance, if you're an enterprise, it's very, very unlikely that you can become a platform company if you're selling only to an enterprise, because enterprise already has so much. Someone put their neck out on the line to buy something. They're not going to rip that out and replace it with whatever you bring them, right? So that's why you see a lot of point solutions in enterprise. In the middle market, these are people who just have like one security person or zero, right? And they just want something that fixes everything. And so that's when they'd start buying a platform. And then the small and medium is sort of a similar situation as well.
In the enterprise, how successful are companies in your experience that they have that point solution and they're just letting other players in the enterprise security market basically take that data because it's a great data point and they're integrating it with their other enterprise solutions? There's a lot of room in that market, correct?
Yeah. We actually really love companies that are able to provide something that's so valuable that they're able to integrate with all the different solutions. You know, it's a very different sales model as well when you do these, when you're basically a threat feed or a solution that's augmenting another one. You know, those tend to be more point solutions than a platform play, but right. Having that ability to integrate with all these different solutions gives you that ability to become a platform company. Hmm. So it's a little different, but you know, that's something that I might have mentioned earlier in terms of, you know, how can it be a platform versus a point solution? Usually platform companies really grow out of new technology shifts, right? So there's going to be a cloud platform play. There's going to be, and I think there have been, some mobile security plays. And so whatever we do next, you know, there's going to be containerization play that's probably attached to cloud. But, you know, that's sort of what drives the creation of a new platform.
Mm. Interesting. Okay, Michael, I'm done with my selfish line of questioning that I was basically asking to help guidance on our own startup, Will, in case you were wondering. So thank you for that. Thank you.
No problem.
Well, and so what I like about this is that, so you started to show us a little bit about having a cyber focus fund and things you're able to do with it. And my brain is going a lot of different directions, but I want to come back to then. So how do you make decisions? Because there's a ton of companies out there. So I'm curious, how often are you going and hunting or farming for deals versus people are just dropping them in your lap? And then how do you sift through all of that to figure out what works? I mean, you've started to show us that you've got some buckets, so you can do at least a high level sorting with it. So what's that process go through? Like how are you guys making these decisions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a key question that a lot of our customers or our LPs ask, right? They say, how do you sift through all these companies? Do you have a clear path on making investments? So for us, we have both the tops down as a bottoms up approach. So the tops down approach is people send us very quality introductions. These people through advisory council, these are customers that we worked with before. And they send us very quality deals that we talk to. You know, if someone just cold emails us, we're probably unlikely to, be extremely interested about it because, at this point, when you have this network, having a warm introduction is very differentiating because there are so many companies out there in the world, today, and a lot of them don't have the context or the ability or, you know, there's just a lot of different pieces. And then also we have a bottoms up approach, which is based on our database. So we have databases over 2,000 cybersecurity companies. We've categorized all of them. We track them. And we are able to find companies, before they're ready to make that investment. You know, we have indicators of success, within our database. And with that, we're able to do outreach as well. So, you know, the way that you think about it is the partners usually do is more, usually a little bit more inbound because they have such a big network that they're just getting deals every single day. And it's, you know, they have to work through those. And then from the junior side, you sort of see them usually go bottoms up where they see a whole mass of companies and they're trying to figure out how to filter it down to the most best companies. And so, through those two different paths, we sort of find our companies.
How long does it take on average? Like from the time that you get an interest in a company, and I know everything is different, but like, is this weeks, months, years? I'm guessing it's not. I'm hoping it's not.
It's not you years. Wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I'm busy, guys. See ya. Anyways, no, it's a couple of months usually. You know, the earliest is probably a month. You can go even earlier and even quicker. But for us, our mindset is that we work with companies that, you know, at the end of the day, investing is like a marriage. And people who don't, when you do more and more deals, you sort of start viewing it that way because you're not just getting money. You're getting a person who sits on your board. You're getting someone to talk to on a weekly or even daily basis. And you spend so much time together that you have to have sort of aligning thoughts on sort of the view of the company, the market. You guys have to have personalities that work well together. And so for us, we're not rushing into deals. Like if we hear a really good deal, we're not going to say, okay, we need to do this deal. We're going to pay the highest price and get in and be that investor. For us, we are, you know, we view ourselves as more value added, more team building type firm. Because we've had such a long time working in cybersecurity, we've, you know, one of the founders was CEO of three of his companies, one of which, several of which, was sold for hundreds of millions of dollars. And so we have a little bit more ability to help these companies shape themselves, and we view it more as a mutual relationship versus just a, hey, here's some money, enjoy.
Well, so then, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about is early stage investing, seed stage investing versus like a Series A or a later stage investing. What you're describing and building those relationships, does that push you towards earlier stage companies or not necessarily? It kind of depends on the maturity of the organization.
Yeah, I think for us, we naturally tend, and you know, this is a lot of it is being introspective, right? We look at our previous deals, which ones have we been especially successful in, and we say, okay, well, we've been, you know, everyone's a little bit different, right? And we saw that we were really, really good at the earlier stages. And I think part of the reason why we're really good at the earlier stages is because we can develop credibility with these entrepreneurs and we can help them build their company. So because of that, we're naturally tended to do early stage type deals. There are investors that are actually very, very focused on doing late stage deals. So these are companies that have already raised $30, $40 million, and they're really good at saying, okay, I know what I want. I'm going to put another $50 million in this company because I believe they're going to be a leader in the space, and I believe they're going to exit for this.
But it's lower risk, right? Like as you go through the stages, ideally there's less risk with the companies at a later stage.
That's right, exactly. So for instance, if you think about yourself, if you're a seed investor and you're putting in, you know, $100K, $200K into a company, how many of those seed investments ultimately get to Series A? We would estimate probably a fourth get there.
Okay.
So if you're a seed investor, you want to be able to get a 4X when one of those companies does well. And then now you're
Series A investor. And that's just to break even.
Right, exactly, right. Exactly. And so now you're Series A. How many of those companies go to Series B and et cetera and keep on moving forward? So there is risk with every single stage. And I think that contributes to the valuation at each of the stages, as well as the comfort of, you know, what has to be there in order for us to invest. So, you know, there's things like market risk, there's team risk, product risk, customer risk. There's all these different elements. And I think a part of our job as company builders is to help these companies de-risk themselves, right? So for instance, this company doesn't really know anyone that's great for VP of sales. We can help them find a VP of sales. Or maybe we think that they should be more of a marketing focus, like inside sales focus versus direct sales. We can help them find a marketing person. So there's a lot of these different things that come together. Let's say they need a customer that helps them define their product because they don't know exactly how, you know, what additional features they do need or their roadmap. Then we bring in design partners who are customers as well.
So, you know, it's interesting, you know, Paul, it wouldn't be a show if we didn't bring up Shark Tank. So we'll hopefully you don't mind us bringing up Shark Tank. But one of the things that's always interesting is at some point somebody will say, well, you know, what do you want from the deal? And they're like, I want your guidance. I want your connections. And what I'm hearing from you is because you guys have specialized this and you're looking at earlier stage deals and you've got this network that you've built, you become attractive then as an investment vehicle, not just because you're going to give them dollars, but because you're going to give them some of the stuff that they don't have. And because you're able to look at over 18, 24 companies over the last couple of years, you can identify the trends and patterns and help them get where they need to be faster. So somebody then sitting at home saying, well, I want to start a company, but I'm never going to take any funding at all. That may be okay, but it's not always, I'm going to take funding and we're going to rock it off. Sometimes it's the funding is a way that you're going to get paid on your expertise, but that they're going to benefit from it too. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So we're adding our value to the company as well. And our value is very, very obvious, right? We are very broad. We see a lot of companies. We talk to a lot of customers. And we can add value from the outside in. Versus when you're a company, you're really focused on one product, one idea, or you know, one type of customer, right? And so it's very hard to see the forest from the trees when you're spending every day trying to generate revenue and generate a product that people want to buy, right? And so having that broader view and that broader network is that we're able to help the company expand.
All right. So let's talk about the difference then between engineers and entrepreneurs, because you've got to be talking to a lot of people that they get the bits, they get the bytes, man, they get security down solid. Running a business and security are not mutually incompatible, but they're not the same. So what do you see? Any lessons learned there?
Yeah, no, it's so let's see, how do I start? So the main, because you know, I know there are a lot of engineers here, right, and people who understand security way more than I could ever understand security in my entire life, right? And so I think that, you know, let's talk about Silicon Valley really quickly. You know, why is Silicon Valley so successful, and why have they been able to maintain their success? They created the idea of a program manager a long time ago, right? And they've been really focused behind it. You know, in Apple, the program, you know, Steve Jobs didn't decide whether the iPhone went out. The program manager for that, or product manager, sorry, for the iPhone decided whether it went out. And what does a product manager do? Product manager sits in between the engineer and the customers. So they're able to collect information from both and ultimately understand what needs to be built. Engineers are amazing because they are extremely technical. They know the latest threats and they know exactly what's going on at the most, you know, deepest and technological level. But a lot of times engineers will build something that they think customers would want, and if only the customer is smart enough to buy it. Customers, on the other hand, they just, you know, they're viewing things very different. They want to accomplish something. Either, you know, their CEO told them, hey, I want to accomplish this. I don't want this to happen to us. They go find a solution or they try to build it themselves. So the product manager is there in the middle to try to synthesize information from both and ultimately help the company build something that the customers ultimately want. So that's sort of a difference between engineer and customer and product manager. Now, what is a good CEO or what is a good entrepreneur? Typically, we found that a good CEO is usually a product manager in a previous life or a VP of sales in a previous life. And because, you know, both of them are similar, or the similarities between both is that they both have interaction with both the customer as well as the technical piece. They understand, you know, what they want to build, they understand what the customer wants, and they can ultimately create something that becomes a scalable business.
So that need to translate, right, to look at both and start figuring it out, right? You gotta be able to look between the two. I like that discipline of it. All right, so what are some of the trends that you think – what are some of the trends you'd like to see some companies in? I know it's not a call for people to start hitting your inbox unsolicited, but like when we look at this and we try to pay attention to where we see things getting funded or trended, how much do you pay attention to the general trends in investments versus say, no, we know what we know. We're talking to our group of advisors. These are things where we'd like to see solutions. So I'm assuming you guys go more that direction. If I'm wrong, correct me. But then what are some things that have you interested in right now that you think in security show promise?
Yeah. So in terms of tracking what other VCs do, we do monitor that. I think the main thing that tracking what that does is, you know, there's only so many companies that can target a specific problem, right? The market isn't large enough, and there are already four or five well-funded companies, it doesn't make sense to try to find another one, right? Because one of those is going to succeed. So that's where we view sort of other VCs. In terms of, you know, trends or how do we get to these theses, a lot of it comes from our customers. A lot of it comes from context, from working with our portfolio companies and the context, the conversations that they have with other people. So, you know, what are things that we are really interested in? You know, we're really interested in our investment in Bayshore networks. We believe that with IoT, specifically industrial IoT, there are millions of dollars, billions of dollars, right, invested in these systems that are being used on a day-to-day basis that's generating value. And, you know, there are the newest IoT devices, the newest wind turbines, engines, those are already built with APIs and connections in mind, right? But what we don't know, think about, is the 50 years of devices that have been deployed and generating value. How do we monitor those? How do we track those? How do we make sure that they are the best they can be, as well as not being attacked? So we've been looking for specifically within industrial IoT as one of our themes, and we've made our investment there. But we believe that the market is big enough that there should be multiple companies that target that. So, for instance, there's companies that focus on edge computing, so computing within the factory instead of somewhere else. And then there's also, you know, cloud platform plays. So where does the data go? How does the data be translated from all these different protocols into something that's usable in terms of both alerts as well as analytics? So that's one theme.
You mentioned some really big platforms.
Yeah.
What about some of the sub-platforms, right? When we look at a security program for an organization, right? Sure, they're going to have cloud computing, but there's all kinds of sub-platforms in there that I'm going to need, you know, asset tracking to vulnerability management. Right. You know, maybe those combine into a platform, but then there's looking at threats. Then there's also, I mean, the endpoints are still endpoints. They're not in the cloud. Yeah. So you're going to need something to help secure your endpoints. It is at a separate platform. So how do you define some of these sub-platforms?
Yeah, no, it's so... you know, there's a lot of different ways to think about it, right? So one thing that you do with OT is you can just say, hey, what worked with IT? And let's move some of those into OT as well and create solutions there. Then there's other ones saying, okay, well, OT is so different, right? There's a lot of data being generated from these that we don't need to monitor. And so, you know, what are different solutions that we need? So asset tracking, I think that is something that was extremely valuable in IT. All right. I mean, we want to know what's on our network. We want to know what's doing what. And the OT side, when you talk to plant managers, they're not as focused on that. They say, hey, I have 3 million devices and every day it's changing. And I'm not focused on that because I'm focused on blah, 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 blah. And so there's just a different mindset. But yes, you're completely right. There needs to be multiple solutions that fit specific problems. And I think the key thing right now is people don't know what problems they need to fix yet.
Along those lines, what about some of the newer IT ones, such as, you know, threat hunting has emerged? Certainly we've seen, well, they call it deception technologies, which is really like glorified honeypots. And then we have, you know, threat detection. But, you know, are those platforms that can stand on their own, or are they just part of a bigger puzzle that they're just going to integrate with? We see ServiceNow, for example, doing a lot of integrations and buying companies.
Yeah.
Is there going to be like one dashboard even for enterprises to manage all this stuff?
That's not Slack.
Yeah, that's not Slack. God.
That's not Slack. Yeah. You know, I think the trouble is when you're trying to create a dashboard for everything, you're just going to have 20 different dashboards, right? Because everyone wants to create that dashboard. And so how do we get to one solution being the ultimate dashboard? That's a very difficult question to answer.
Right. Because you want to invest in that company that's going to have that dashboard, right?
Like
that's one of your
single
investments.
Single pane of glass, baby. Yeah.
We saw in like 3 press releases over the past month. Single pane view.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of companies are trying and they're angling for that. John and I do the Enterprise Security Weekly Show. We're covering these solutions and we definitely see people angling for that. So.
Yeah, and it's you know, think about yourself as a customer, right? Yes, I want a single pane of glass, but do I really trust this startup to be that single pane of glass for me?
Right.
Do they have enough integrations? And I think that's a key issue with a lot of these companies. Building these integrations is phenomenally tough.
Yeah.
And that's been the same for years, for decades, right?
Yeah, and it's not a one-shot deal to build an integration. That's something that has to be like nurtured and cultured over time and kept up with and maintained.
Well, and this is one of those things where I've changed over the past 12 to 24 months. Whenever I'm talking to customers and potential customers, talking to IONS customers, they're saying, we want this bright, shiny thing. And I used to be like, yeah, you know, go with the bright, shiny thing. That's a really cool, bright, shiny thing. But it's becoming more and more apparent that there are so many bright, shiny things. Last year, we were talking on Enterprise Security Weekly how there's a tremendous amount of fatigue in plugins and agents that are installed on systems. Oh, yeah. Some of our customers have 20, 30 agents. They don't even know what half of them do. And now with a lot of the customers, I'm saying if you can get 80% of the functionality of that bright, shiny object and it integrates with your existing like Symantec McAfee solution, or it is that solution, you better just go with that solution because you have one centralized point of management. You have one centralized point of report. It's getting to the point where it's almost impossible to manage all of these little scattered devices that are all over the place, all these different security panes of glass all over the place. And I think that that's a big shift that you and I have been seeing for the past 24 months, and I think it's just now starting to hit.
Yeah, and I think you know another really interesting shift is that a lot of people are trying to build solutions, right, products, because they see the big exits, and they're saying, okay, wow, this person was able to sell the company for 100 times revenue, right, something insane. And the key reason was it was a product that the acquirer could get quickly get synergies from, right? You know, the customer, the product was generating $1 million revenue. You put it into Oracle, it can generate $100 million revenue. So Oracle's more than happy to pay you 100 times revenue then because they're going to get their payback within a year. You know, there are those companies. But I do think that we need more services companies. I think there's such a big gap. And I know you guys talked about how there really isn't a gap in security personnel. You know, a lot of people say that there isn't enough, and you guys say, oh, well, you have to train them, right? You have to focus. You have the people within your organization. You have to train them and nurture them, and then they will fill that gap for you, right? A lot of companies don't have the ability to do that training, right? They don't have enough big enough security team to take someone from IT to security. And so I believe that there need to be more companies that solve a specific problem and either use technology or people to do it. So, for instance, you know, really simple ideas like, for instance, DIN, right? DIN does DDoS. Or, sorry, not DDoS. DNS. Oops. yeah.
That was a bit of a Freudian slip.
That's a new side business.
They're going to call me later.
but, yeah, so they do DNS, and they, you know, you could be focusing on yourself. You could hire up people, and you can build the servers, or you could just let DIN do it, right? And because they have that economies of scale, they can do it much cheaper and doesn't make sense to not buy it. I think that there's going to be that situation with people as well. So, you know, one example is, you know, Gartner has this thing called managed detection and response, right? And so what these people do is they basically take all your alerts and then they triage them. They say, okay, you know, which of these are important? Okay, these aren't important. Let's figure out what the heck this one is. Okay, this one's pretty important. I have a little bit of data coming for your network. Let me take a look into it and make sure this is actually really interesting. And then they say, okay, it is interesting. Here, security team, look at this. You need to fix it.
And I think that gets into one of my big questions that I wanted to ask you is, with what you do for a living, it's a difficult position, right? Because you have to actually look at security products and you have to say whether or not that works. So whenever you're looking at managed security service providers or you're doing incident response or any of those, the vast majority of them don't work, almost to the point where you can say, they all don't work. I mean, whenever you're talking less than 1%, that's not a very good percentage. So how do you personally look at a company that's coming up with something like that, that flat out hasn't been working in a lot of ways, and you can look at them with fresh eyes and not be burdened with all of your previous prejudices about all the technologies that may have tried to do something like that and failed? How do you look at them and say, this is something we should invest in? This just doesn't sound like a good idea. This doesn't look like something that we can turn around and sell, but this is actually a really good idea that's going to forward security in our customers, propel it forward.
Yeah. I think that we have seen, and we've actually helped nurture a bunch of our companies to do that. You know, they had a really interesting idea, and for whatever reason, they weren't getting the traction that they wanted. And so then we'd help them pivot and move towards something that was actually the customers actually value. And so for us, when we see a company like that, that has this long history of technology not working, people don't want to use it, or, you know, they just haven't gotten the traction that they wanted to, it is a longer conversation, right? Because we have to figure out, hey, are you willing to work with us? Will you treat us as a trusted advisor? And will you, you know, can we work together to create this new thing? And that's just the ultimate thing of working with people, right? Sometimes if a company raises, you know, $50 million, a $200 million pre, and they go through that whole cash, and at the end of it, they don't have enough to raise that next round. Some companies aren't willing to change, right? They're not willing to say, hey, okay, well, obviously that didn't work. Let's do something else. They're willing to say, okay, well, you know, a top-tier investor invested at 200 pre, and they gave me $50 million, and now my company is worth 250. Can you just give me a 250 pre, and we'll keep going from there, right? And so that's just it's a people element, and I think that, you know, that comes back to sort of the whole investing as a marriage, right? These people, we need to be able to work together, and we need to have similar mindsets. If they believe that they can do this, and we believe that they should do this, if they don't want to listen to our view, or we can't work together and find a middle ground, then we can't make those investments.
Yeah, and hopefully you find that out at the beginning of the relationship, just like you said, a marriage.
yeah, exactly, right.
Investing is a marriage. That might explain some of your thoughts and feelings behind
a lot of different things. Yeah.
John's like, I'm already married.
You already know my background. Yeah. Just throw it over here. We have a tradition here at Security Weekly. Anytime we have a big show milestone, I would say episode 100, yeah. 200, Joff 300.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen yesterday, but it just happened now. I just dumped scotch into my computer. We actually have a number of computers up here that have had beer poured in them at these important milestones.
Okay.
It was thirsty. But it might actually survive. So if you can just find a company that can help us recover systems that get scotch or
poured
on them, we'll invest immediately. So
well, and it sounds too Will, you just basically laid out one of the things that we've heard from a lot of people, which is you're investing as much in the team as you are the idea. The technology is important, and it needs to have traction or tractability, but you're looking for a team where you believe in them, they believe in you, there's a good fit, and together you guys are going to do great stuff. I am really excited about your launch. I'm thrilled that you're able to join us, and hopefully you'll come back and give us an update at some point on how things are going, or maybe even give us some thoughts on the field.
One closing thing, Will, in terms of investing in the people, and I think some people mistake that and say, well, that means I really don't have to like have sales or know my numbers. Like, if I can get Will to like me and John, like, you'll invest in our company. But you the company still have to be able to answer questions and show that we can have sales and all of those other fundamentals. It's not just about the people, right? That's certainly an important
part of it.
Component,
yeah.
Right?
And I would say, how often does it happen? Another kind of add-on is, how often does it happen that you're working with people, you hit it off, you like them, and it just doesn't work? For whatever reason, you can't bring the funding to the table, and then they're personally hurt. They're like, this must be, you know, something about me.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the personal level, that's more important when everything else already makes sense, right? The market makes sense, the technology makes sense, the team is there, or we feel the team might not be completely done, but we feel very confident to be able to de-risk and augment that.
Yeah.
Or the product might not be completely there, or the customer's not completely, but we just feel very comfortable that we can add our value even before we invest or while we invest and fix all those things.
No, that makes perfect sense, and other investors have said the exact same thing to us, so.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, sometimes you'll see someone that raises, especially when they get a really attractive offer, like, you know, you mentioned before, like $100 million pre, even though they have zero revenue and they're able to raise $25 million. That's so attractive. It's really hard
How
to not
that
take that. Yeah. And a lot of times that happens because of your background, right? You've done something so amazing in your prior companies and people believe you can do it again. And we believe that as well. But, you know, let's say it doesn't work out, right? $25 million later, you in 1 or 2 years, you don't have enough to raise that $200 million pre. What do you do at that point? And so, you know, sometimes you'll talk to entrepreneurs that actually don't take that crazy high offer because they know that if they take that crazy high offer, they won't be able to achieve that next step.
Right.
And so, you know, for us, it's all about being reasonable. We've done enough deals, 30 cybersecurity deals, that we know what it looks like, right? What the team needs to look like, what the product needs to look like, the customer, the market, you know, what does the company need to look like so that they can get acquired or IPO. And, you know, at the end of the day, not the end of the day, but something I've heard a lot in VC is a lot of it's pattern matching, right? You know, you've done enough deals that you sort of know what works and what doesn't. And some of it is like, you know what you know, right? Or you don't know what you don't know. And so some people don't know what they don't know. They think, okay, if I have an amazing idea, I can raise $5 million from VCs. I just need to go to the Bay Area and just talk to everyone and I'll get it. And that's not the case, right? Like comes with experience and doing a bunch of deals, which is, we're excited to do more.
Well, yeah. And I'm excited to learn from you. So I appreciate it. And I know that as the industry heats up, you know, you've offered us some insights, and hopefully we can come back to you and you can offer us some more, so that, because this is one of those things, like when I look at our role, it's legitimizing the security conversation in a startup community. So you guys are focusing on security startups, which is great, because obviously it's a natural overlap with what we do. But I think there's a lot of people out there too, you know, even looking at IoT, who, knowing that there's people who are solving this, I think helps everybody. So I know I'm liking, you know, I learned a lot today, and I'm getting smarter as a result of it. And I appreciate your time and your effort and your time prepping us. And again, congratulations on the launch of the fund. I'm looking forward to some good things coming out of that.
We're setting the bar high for you, Will. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It was wonderful having you.
It was wonderful to be here. Thank you, guys.
Thanks to be here.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Will. We'll take a short break. Come back with the startup security news for this week.
LogRhythm's Netmon Freemium delivers real-time network visibility to quickly identify emerging threats in your IT environment. Netmon Freemium is a free commercial-grade network forensics and traffic analytics solution. You can use Netmon Freemium's powerful capabilities to search against all of observed network traffic, identify abnormal traffic patterns and application usage, and quickly analyze full packet captures. Take the first step towards real-time network visibility. Visit logrhythm.com/freemium to learn more and download it today.
Welcome back, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. Here with John Strand in studio and Michael Santarcangelo on the lines via Skype. And we're going to talk about some startup news. Some startup, I don't know if they're stories, articles. I'm still struggling with the right word. Like, every time I say it, it feels like, anyway, we'll come up with a better word for it. But you got stories with tractors and stuff. That's the one.
Dude,
that,
that's the one I wanted to.
Can we
to jump
start
into.
With that one? Because John and I feel
let's
like it was written
let's
about
go
us.
To that one. Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes whenever the stories come up, I feel like he finds these stories and he puts them out, and he's like, "Yeah, John's gonna bite on that one." This one has tractors. Yes. So, and Paul knows that I love backhoes, and he loves backhoes.
I do. I'm a huge fan.
I now see why we get along. I will stop and check out tractors. Mm.
You need to come out to South Dakota. I've got lots of
heavy machinery. We almost moved there, not far from where you are.
And firearms.
We were traveling by RV. That was one of the two spots. And then we ended up Myrtle Beach, which was not one of the two spots.
Well, you may be, you know, looking for places, I'm telling you, it's a good place. Come on out. I got a house that you can stay in, and it's out in the middle of the woods, and you guys got a place to stay. Perfect. So this particular article really resonated with me. Now, for those of you that don't know, Paul talks a lot about our startup, and Paul has a different perspective that I do, and he gets a lot of assistance from Michael, and he gets a lot of assistance from the people that come on the show, and Ron Gula, and that's not my thing. And that's intentional. Paul's the CEO. I kind of do the CTO thing. And one of the things that resonated with me about this article is it kind of set up a lot of the stuff that's happened since we started this. So if we go through, we start about sprint, stumble, recover. I think, my God, that is absolutely the truth. Yep. Because one of the things that's important is getting something done right. Because if we would have started with the way we had started the product a year ago, we would have done it completely wrong, been committed to doing it wrong, and it would have been even more expensive than it actually was. When we first started, we did Electra, what is it? Elk Stack.
Yeah.
Elasticsearch, Logstash, and Kibana.
But then we did the Node.js interface, which is kind of the same.
It worked. But that's a whole different story. But we're finding out that these different technologies do not fit the specific space.
Right.
And what else is interesting is when we look at a lot of the vendors that are kind of following what we do whenever we give presentations, we'll talk to some of the vendors, and they're like, we're doing full log analysis beaconing, and we're running an ELK. And it's like, why are you doing that? Well, we saw your presentation. You're like, oh, God.
Oh, no.
But they have like a lot of developers committed to it, and they're going to fail a lot bigger.
Yep.
And that was something that was very interesting. There's lots of stumbling that goes with it. Natural time, it talks about efficiency. I would also say inefficiency. Whenever you're moving into anything that you do, you fully expect that things are going to take longer. They're inevitably going to take longer. And then the big one is this, trust your vision. And this is one of those things that's very fundamentally different for Paul and myself. We have an idea as far as hunt teaming, and we had an idea for active defense, and Paul made a joke about honeypots. And we constantly joke about it. We talked about active defense for 6-7 years. And everybody took everything that we talked about, and they turned it into a better honeypot with a better GUI. And that isn't what we were talking about. Honeypots have been around for a long time. So that's part of the vision, building out the product for, you know, doing cyber attribution, the trackback application. And also on the AI hunt, we had a place where we wanted to go, and we kept on moving towards it. And the other thing is we've seen a lot of companies that have actually failed at doing the implementation of threat hunting.
Well, and I think it's important when they say trust your vision, Michael, I think it's important. One of the things John and I did early on was we challenged the vision. I think each of us challenged the vision, and it got into some heated discussions. But coming out of that, John and I now completely 100% trust the vision. And I think it's important for early on, for the founders, whoever you are, to have that conversation, because you're going to come out of it and have a much better foundation.
I can tell you definitively that's a really good idea. And when we look at it too, it's people sometimes don't want to have that conflict, and you need to. You guys are good friends. You guys work well together. Have the conflict. Get it out and resolve it. And have that clarity of that vision and that focus, and that'll carry you through. What I'm starting to see now in a lot of like post-Series A startups is they had a founder or a team, and by hook or by crook, they forged that vision. And hey, look, now we just added the team. They lose sight of that vision. Mm. Once they lose sight of that vision, they can't get the traction they want. Everything starts stalling. Deals that they used to be able to turn in 3 to 6 months are now taking 12 to 15 months. You know why? Because they lost sight of it. So I think the thing to keep in mind too is that have it, check it, and then make sure other people have bought into it and they understand it the same way you do. You guys went through some nuance to get where you are.
And the other thing is, a lot of what we're doing involves education. And whenever we talk, I'm not going to mention some of the companies that do this. We see them failing, and we see companies that have failed, not because their product didn't rock, but because they couldn't sell the damn thing. And a lot of people don't understand the space, and that's okay. And I think that that's one of the things with Security Weekly that we bring to the table, is we can actually build that market by building better security engineers. There's another little logo in here that I thought was fantastic. It had the little Mario upgrade thing with the fire. Where is that one? Where you're not selling a product.
Your customers don't care.
Yeah, you're selling an upgrade, improvement. It's your customers don't care, exactly. And it has Mario, it shows Big Mario throwing fireballs, and that's what people want. And that's right there, the little flower that teaches you to shoot fireballs out of your mouth. That's Security Weekly, and that's what it's always been. And that's what we're ultimately trying to do, is put a product in place that allows people to upgrade their NOCs, upgrade their skill sets, so we can actually do that. So this article resonated with me a lot. I think that also, Michael, I think one of the big things that's been good is I've got a pretty good idea what water I want to play in here. Paul has a good idea what water he wants to play in here. And as much as I think Paul likes getting his hands dirty and playing with the technology, he knows where he's better focused. And I think that that helps great. And me trying to stay the hell out of his way is also important.
Well, you know, and what's great about that too, though, is that, so if we go back and we look at it internally, what that means is you guys, even if it's developing your own shorthand, your communication is going to have a lot less friction. And you're going to have that understanding that you need to have in order to get where you want to be. And that's fantastic. You know, if you go back to the customers buying progress, and you already said this, and I think you said it really succinctly, most of these products that don't work, it's because they don't know how to sell them. It's because they don't understand the problem that they're actually trying to solve. They get excited, and I get this. I fell prey to it myself. You get excited about the features of something, and you kind of lose sight of what it's able to do. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. People don't buy because you've got some widget, or they like the switch, or it's a polished knob. None of that shit matters to them. They want to know, do you understand my actual problem? And if I give you money, am I better as a result? By the way, if you're in security today and you struggle getting your budget, it's because the CFO doesn't care about an ROI. What the CFO is asking you is, if I give you this pile of cash, are we better because of it? Yes or no? And if it's like security, we're better. That's not convincing to anybody. And it doesn't work when you're trying to sell security.
And I like what you said about ROI. A lot of people have been trying to sell security in the concepts of ROI. And I don't think that that works, right? It didn't work 10 years ago. It's not working.
What I would
today.
Say is it can work. It's not worth it. Right. Well, I mean, like, because my background is as an economist. So when somebody says, oh, you can't do it, bullshit, totally do it. Is it worth doing it? No. No, it's the wrong measure, and it's fascinating. We in security, we look at it and we say, oh, well, they asked for an ROI. Yes, because they don't know any other way to say to you, I don't understand what you're telling me, and I don't understand if there's any value in this, so what do I get for giving you the money? But if you talk to most CFOs and you say, do you really want an ROI analysis? They'll say, no.
Well, so you're measuring it wrong, and I think, Michael, one of your things is like, how do you measure it? And I think it's such a, it's an equally as a profound question as what problem you're trying to solve. Like, it's the next question, right? Like, okay, my solution. Okay, it's the fourth question.
But it's the question.
Yeah.
What questions
do
you
measure
it?
ROI is not how you measure it.
And you have people that come to us, and it's great because I don't have to sell to CEOs. They know who we are. They come to us for, like, penetration tests on BHS.
That's a good situation
to be in. And they have a question, and we can answer that question. And I think with the products that we're getting into, I think there's two questions that we're setting out to answer. And Paul and I spend a lot of time talking about this crap. You know, the question is, who is attacking us right now? I think that we have products that can help answer that question. And the other question is, are we currently compromised by bad guys that are good enough to bypass the advanced technologies that we have in place to detect them? If you can answer questions, that's far more powerful, I think, than the concept of ROI. I think that ROI was a trap. People had this idea of what C-O's believed. They created a straw man for what C-O's believed. It was incorrect. It was based off of Hollywood. And they completely screwed it up.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it was based off of Hollywood, and I know you're using that categorically, but it was based from, there was a misunderstanding. We went, we asked for money, they said no. We said, why not? They said, I don't understand the ROI. We went, ROI? Oh. And then we then tried, we Googled it. Didn't go anywhere, and then we said, well, ROI is stupid. ROI is not stupid, but I think Paul said it right. It's not the right measure for this. But, you know, I'm up front with everybody. When I look at value, and we give people five lenses of value, and you can compute an emotional, a logical, and a financial value. If I give you a pile of cash, frankly, 90 days from now, I want to know that it's generating some sort of a positive value, and that's what I want to measure. And positive value isn't always, is it giving me more money in the bottom line? No. Is it increasing the value of your team? Are you making better decisions about risk faster? Are you increasing your resilience? Are these the things that are going to help you as a company? Good. Fine. Make that case. And that goes back to your point. If I can ask intelligent questions and I can give you answers, you know, because as soon as you mentioned that, who's attacking me, what popped in my head is, yeah, and do I have the right protections in place? And do I even know how to respond to that? And what does that mean? That leads to so many places that have good conversations. That's exactly what we want. But we need to be able to answer. I got to tell you, I'm doing this with a lot of companies right now. And when I get to the value and the measurement questions, it is a struggle. And I either get a, dude, I don't even know, and people throw their hands up, or they say, yeah, I don't know, but we'll try to figure it out. That's where, as an industry, we got to do a better job of trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And I think it all starts with very uncomfortable questions. And I think
they're exceptionally,
you know,
uncomfortable.
Like, learning about you over the years, you know, one of those things, you came into the show on Security Weekly, and you are inherently a different creature than most of the people that are on Security Weekly. And I don't think you hide from that at all. And it's one of those things where you ask the very, very difficult questions that the propeller heads cannot ask. And a lot of times they cannot answer. Yeah. Exactly. And that is, I think that's a fundamental shift that is missing in a lot of the conversations. And it goes back to the widget thing that I mentioned. Everyone wants a new shiny widget, and that's great. But if it doesn't interact with the existing infrastructure, if it doesn't support the existing infrastructure, do I have to go out and have another view of it? Do I have to go and retrain my entire team on a new technology? Then that may be really, really cool. But you haven't asked that really painful, hard to answer question. And I think that's kind of one of those things that you've been bringing to the show for the past few years. And I think that helps. And it's hitting a lot of people in IT kind of sideways.
Yeah. And I'm on a mission to keep doing it. And I'll tell you, it's fascinating because the questions that I ask, they seem so simple until you start diving into them. And then you're like, whoa. Just to be clear, I'm never trying to create an existential crisis in people. I've looked at it from both sides because I'll tell you what, I ask this of a lot of leaders in organizations, and a lot of them are like, well, Michael, which is code for, I'm about to throw a whole bunch of shit your direction, and I hope some of it you like. And it doesn't normally work that way. But these are questions but I'll tell you what though, when you get better at asking these questions, you make better decisions. When you make better decisions, you get the reputation of making better decisions. And then that leads you to a whole lot of really good things. And so, yeah, we'll keep doing it. We'll keep working it. And this is the interesting thing to keep in mind too. This is what I like about doing this part of the program too. If you're in a security team today, then it's not just, are you buying, you know, you have customers too. And so it's not just, oh, I'm buying this to solve a problem. It's what are the problems your organization needs to solve? And we're not good at that. But here's the beauty. In security, you totally have the ability to be good at it. We, by our nature, we have to touch everything. And if you can bring some of that curiosity to play, man, you're going to really understand that organization better than everybody else. And that sets you up for some good long-term success. So I like that.
Well, and I like how it's multifaceted too. Like, the things we talk about to make product company successful and understanding the right questions to ask also apply to the people we're talking to who work for an organization, because they have to either have the questions asked of them or ask the questions of others in their organization to, like Michael's saying, better understand the organization so that when I sit on the product vendor, there's a flow of information. And it's like a what we know in order to be effective at creating and selling a product, they're also selling a product too. When you're a security person working in a company, like you're selling the product of
security, right?
Well, so you have to know those things too.
And it's one of the things, you remember Scott Weil from years ago at the SANS Institute. He said, you're never, and he was talking about this with SANS training, and I think it applied to what we do at BHIS. You are never, ever selling directly to the people who picked up the phone and called you. You are not selling to the technical person that wants to go to SANS training. You are not selling to... the IDS analyst or the network penetration tester. You're selling to his or her boss.
Yep.
And you have to equip those people that you're talking to become your salespeople, to be able to talk to their bosses. And if you don't give them the tools that they need to effectively communicate your message, you're going to lose all the time. And that kind of also goes
back. I couldn't agree with that more. Yep. I completely agree.
I love this, this other article. I don't think we look at things this way. Why do you need to cross half your prospects off of your list? I think if you're crossing half your prospects off of your list, then your messaging is wrong. And I think that this particular article, I think that it actually sidesteps that entire problem. Because we have found, I don't know, what was the last time Melissa talked about? Like, it's well into the 60s of the people that come to us actually convert into sales. Now, it doesn't happen directly. It might be 60-70%.
I think you've got a really good point on that. I think you're right. I think that's a messaging thing. I put this in, and let's talk about both of these at the same time. Funnels for startups. So let me give everybody a crash course on funnels. If you don't understand it, this is important. And I'm going to draw a different side of this, too. So the funnel is how companies view people moving through it. You'll also hear people talk about customer journeys. And now for as much as you'll see about it, you'll see written about how it's all rubbish and that's not the direction we should go. But I'll tell you something interesting. The deeper I'm getting into understanding sales and understanding those processes and why they're important and the buy-in you need at each of those places. I mean, John, this goes to your point. If you've got the messaging right and you understand who your target market is and you understand their pain points the way you guys do, then you've eased, right? You've given them a cognitive ease to be able to move through that process and make those cases to people, and it lets you have a very high conversion rate. That's awesome. That's a really powerful sign, and that's the kind of thing that like Will Lynn would look at and go, okay, these guys get it. They understand it. There's a flip side to it, and I'm going to tie a couple things together. I'll name the name. It was HubSpot. HubSpot reaches out. Like if you go to their website, first of all, they do great content and that's how they get you. So HubSpot's one of those, we help you with your website and we help you with your automation marketing and we help you with your automation sales and all those sorts of stuff. They're good. They're a bit of a premium, but they're worth it. Every time you go to their website and download something, you get somebody who pretty much the next day sends you a note and says, hey, I noticed you're on our website and I took a look at your website and I'd love to talk to you. And so what I've done is I've decided I'm never going to be rude to them because I don't know if I'm going to work with HubSpot or not. I might. So what I do is I send back a note. And I actually, the woman who sent me the note, I sent back and I said, listen, I'm not a prospect at this point. Here's why. Here's the stage I'm at. Here's the situation I'm in. Here's why I'm not a good fit. And I wrote, P.S., I'm not throwing an objection to give you a way to come back and combat the objection. I'm actually just leveling with you. But here's the deal. If you need or want, you know, like if you still want to talk to me, I'll create time. If not, look, I'll keep you. She wrote back, thank you so much. This is really helpful. Yeah. Level with me. We're good to go. I think what happens then is I saw something today on LinkedIn, and it was like, you know, somebody in your network likes it type of a thing. But it was a recruiter saying, I just made 4 hard conversations to tell somebody we went a different direction. But you know what? I think it's really important not to leave people hanging and to close that loop and to keep those relationships alive. And what I'm seeing happening a lot of times in the security space is we're not really good at that on both sides of the fence. Like there's a lot of people in security that do act like vultures. And I know that's maddening to a lot of people. And as we're bearing down on RSA, we know that volume is going to creep up for a while. I think what I'd like to see then as we get to more of the straight talk is understand that funnel and recognize that, you know what, sometimes you are a qualified lead. But let me tell you what I've boiled it down to, because this really unlocked a bunch of stuff for me this week. You have people that are prospects, and what makes somebody a prospect is that they have a problem that you can solve in a way that adds value to their situation. And then it's an opportunity when that prospect says, I have that problem, and I'm ready to change. The status quo of their situation is not bearable, they'll go through the discomfort of change to get whatever you can offer them in its place. They're excited about that. Where that starts to get exciting then is that when you're looking at stepping out and doing a startup, you got to go sell to somebody, and you got to go sell to somebody that you don't know. And if it's a $1,000 sale, that's great. And over time, you're going to learn what John's learned. There's a way that you can meet the right people that are looking for what you're able to do. They're prospects because they have the problem where you can add value, and they're excited, and you can guide them through that. And I'm willing to bet you guys have a sense of how long it takes from the first time you contact them and how many calls they need or what information to send them. I think
I'm happy with that. I think that it's so incredibly variable, and I think that you lose sight of it if you start getting frustrated. We have engagements where they'll sign on Friday and we start on Monday. We have engagements where we sent a proposal in 8 months ago to a year ago. And I think that that's another point. You know, if you have patience and you're working with people, then they feel more comfortable. It's kind of like that whole, like whenever people are like, well, I can't seem to get a date. Well, if you seem panicked, if you seemed rushed, it's never going to work out. You got to be okay with yourself at some point. And I think that that's huge. The reason why this particular article does bother me, and I just kind of hit upon it, is this becomes, as far as I can tell, a way for managers to justify whenever sales figures start going down in their organization. Whenever you have people, sales engineers, who are okay, but they're not rock stars, then you can start developing these types of metrics to make that all right. And that was something that we dealt with.
That's an interesting point.
That was something that we dealt with a while ago. We don't really have that problem much now. But if I was on a sales call, or if Paul was on a sales call, the odds of that sale coming through...
I don't go on sales calls for BJS.
That's right.
It's a whole backstory.
It doesn't ever happen, ever. If Paul ever assisted, or his presence was there hypothetically, then that conversion rate was much, 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 much higher. And we found out that... if we weren't, then it would be much lower. Okay. So we could justify that and say, well, it's a lower percentage, and it's a percentage that we're okay with. Or you can try to figure out exactly what the hell's going on in that overall process and try to better train your people so that they can be more successful.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that's missing from this, is we have a lot of people that are sales engineers. They have an idea of how sales actually work. But some of our best salespeople that we've ever met, like Brian Correa, who is with Sands and is now with ISC Squared, doesn't seem like a salesman. Yeah, he did. Doesn't seem like a salesman at all. If you go to Alex Horan, not a sales guy, but many people buy their product because of Alex.
Yeah. Well, and so there's an interesting point that, and I don't mean to interrupt your flow because it was really good, but you know what's making you uncomfortable about it is almost exactly why I put this in, and why I wanted to tackle those two together. You know, there's a way that people buy, and so at some level you need to be cognizant of it. But then I think on our side we need to be cognizant that it's okay to be in that kind of a situation, and if we can talk more candidly about it, the reason we like the people who don't feel like salespeople is because they're always bringing us value. Mm-hmm. It's worth talking to them. They're interesting, and I feel good as a result of that exchange. So when I need something, I'm happy to call them. I'm happy to go figure that out. Yeah. And so we do find people. The reason that we just keep hammering the phone is because we watch Glenn Larry again Ross, and we know, okay, well, I got to always be closing, and you know, and it's a great clip to send around to people. But there is a point at which it would be good to say to somebody, look, man, I'm not a prospect. I'm not trying to solve that problem. Well, I'm not throwing objections to be a jerk, like whatever. But then – so there's – I'm looking at it from both sides to go, that's kind of interesting. I don't know.
Well, you got to shrink the top of that funnel too. And I think the mistake that a lot of companies make is the top of that funnel is so big. And it kind of speaks to
where... It's everybody,
yeah,
right?
Where Mike and I talk about, like, my product solves everyone's problems.
Everybody,
it's like, no. Start with a much smaller funnel that is more focused, that's based on facts, that's based on research. And then I think even better than always be closing, right, is what John talks about. Have a really good sales enablement program. Yeah. Enable your salespeople. I think is even more important than just to go to your sales team and be like, always be closing, right?
Yeah.
No, you have to give them the tools and the knowledge and the expertise to be able to handle that smaller funnel.
Yeah, unless we cross over too much, that doesn't mean they want another battle card. I have never been in an organization where they said, you know what would really help me here is another battle card.
What's up?
Give me another PowerPoint.
Battle cards help at the lower end of the funnel. That's where the customers are bringing up the competitive competitors.
Oh, if they bring up X,
Y. You battle against something else.
Battle could be internal too. Like battle could be a battle with an internal. So they're like, I'm not going to buy your product because we're going to develop this internal process. So usually your product team would come up with a battle card to say, these are your talking points for sales about how you can explain value of our product versus something they'd either build internally or against another, but only bring that up into the conversation if the customer brings it up. And it's only something you bring up like when you're deeper into the sales process.
Wow. I didn't even know about that. You learn something new every day.
That was my life for a while.
Hey, let me take you guys through some of the startup notes of interest. So there's a couple of things here I thought were interesting. One caught me off guard, so I'm curious if it caught you guys off guard. I'm going to kind of take some of these a little bit out of order. So VC firms back record number of cybersecurity startups. And then it lists Trident Capital, there's Allegis Capital, 1011 Ventures, and then one of these in here was, the chatbot Demisto, $20 million, and that was with Jay Leek. And we just talked about him last week leaving from Blackstone to go do this exact type of thing. This is why every time we do these stories about doom and gloom, there's no money, the deals were off, the IPOs were low, I keep saying that's looking at the wrong stuff. This is – security is still hot. There's still money to be had if you've got a good idea. But I think what we've talked about is if you've got a good idea and you have a good team and a proper vision and you can execute on fundamentals – There's money out there for you.
Yep. Well, and I see a huge shift in it too. I mean, people think that the trajectory for a lot of these companies is going to continue in the IPO type trajectory. And I think in the last segment that we had, we talked about multiple different quote unquote exit strategies. Mm-hmm. It's not always that one thing. And you talk about the money that's getting dropped into this industry. My biggest fear isn't the fact that there's no money in it. The IPOs aren't going as big as they should. My biggest fear is, are we starting to build a bubble insofar as VC funding going into these things? That's a much larger fear for me. I don't think we're there yet, but I think it's definitely on the horizon.
I agree with you. I share that fear. And the thing that I keep looking at is that as we have more cybersecurity firms being established and more people going into it that have that experience, I think that might resist it a little bit. I don't know.
Well, we see a lot of companies exiting successfully in security as well, which tells me that it's not a, you see a bubble if there's investment going in and there's no exits going out.
You know what's interesting? I may be completely off base on this, but looking at the fact that I think it's going to be more M&A than IPO, that might work to counter a bubble. Because in M&A, They're not inclined to overpay for stuff. It doesn't mean they don't. I just mean categorically.
But we've already seen a lot of successful exits, even years ago. I mean, look at SourceFire. Look at all these companies, right? Yeah. I mean, these were good exits for these companies. Hopefully, the customers are still happy after the M&A, which is mixed success. But
I agree with the M&A. I think that deflates the pressure. I think if you go IPO, you still have this tremendous amount of pressure to perform. If you are VC-funded, you have a tremendous pressure to perform. And, you know, I think Paul and I have talked about it a number of times. The idea of IPO is not something that's interesting at this point at all. I mean,
I think there's a lot of people who feel that same way, that when they start looking at it, because a lot of people think, and I love the fact that you guys asked this question, a lot of people look at VC money and they go, oh, so I got to go IPO? No, that is not the only exit strategy. There are other exit strategies. And what I can tell you, and Will talked about this, he said, you know, a lot of the big companies now, they're not putting their dollars in R&D. What they're doing is they're building relationships into the startup space and saying, hey, somebody else will do it, right? It's almost like on-spec research and development. And if you like it, hey, okay, then I'll buy it. By the way, I'll come back to, because I'm positioned where I get to go work with both. I'm working with startups and I'm working with the big firms. You know the biggest problem the big firms have with startups? Michael, I don't understand what they do. I don't understand if they solve a problem that I have. And because I don't understand it, I can't engage with them. And that's why it's taking some of these firms so long to get traction. And that gives us some of these type of opportunities. So I thought some of that stuff was neat. There were some big numbers this week. And the one that I just started to look into was security startup StackPath. They've got $180 million in funding. And it looks like they're basically positioning themselves to compete with Akamai or something related to that. And they made a couple, I think they grabbed like MaxCDN or Stitic Quick, and they started to put stuff around it. I think that's the other thing we're going to start to see. I think we're going to start seeing people give you a big pile of cash and then say, okay, it's your job, big pile of cash holder. Go pull in the stuff you want and build me something better as a result.
I do also think, like you're talking about them going competing with Akamai and some of those big players. If I was investing and I saw somebody like Akamai trying to do something and maybe floundering at it, I don't want to pick on anything, but take any of the security technologies that they tried to come out with and they're not exactly exploding as much as they'd like them to. If I was investing, I would try to find a company that's doing what a large company like Oracle buying Dyn. That was a great example that was brought up earlier. If you have something that Akamai is trying to do and you have a company that does it better, and Akamai has more money than God, or Oracle has more money than God, that is a great company to invest in, because that large player or one of their large competitors is inevitably going to come in and try to buy them out. Yep. It's basically fishing, and they're the bait at that point, and you're going for bigger fish.
Yeah, I completely agree. The other ones I threw up just because they were big numbers they came across. I actually had like 6 or 7 I left off the list this week, so I'll throw them on next week. But as we're coming up to our RSA, I think we're going to see a lot more announcements made. Evident.io, 22 million, which I was kind of surprised by. And I knew the name, but I hadn't really looked at them.
We talk about them a lot on Enterprise.
We talked about them, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cloud infrastructure security services that enables companies to automate key security processes and compliance reporting. Yeah, I mean, they're basically, I hate to say cloud security company, but they're a cloud security company.
They're not. I like the word CASB. I think that's been one of my favorite acronyms over the past 20 years.
Cloud Access Security Broker?
Yes, CASBs.
CASB. They are a CASB. Yep.
So I think there's a lot of things. What I hope we're going to be able to start doing too is looking at some of these things differently. I mean, John, I love the fact that you're here because we get to do some of that interplay between what you guys are seeing in enterprise and what's coming up. I'm sure we'll cover security startups that go after consumers. Go ahead, show me what they are. We'll talk about them. I think what we're going to look at is enterprise play stuff.
Yeah, but in so far, security companies going after the consumer are larger players in the consumer networking market, AV market, that are going after primarily right now. They're trying to solve the IoT problem for the home user. I don't see a lot of, and they're not, so there's not investments in startups that are doing that, although I have seen startups try to play in that space. Largely, I don't think they're getting funding. I'm not sure exactly why.
It's a horrible play.
But I understand that I've seen actually that larger companies, I think it's D-Link and some other manufacturers, make like an IoT security device, which I think it's interesting. Here's an IoT device to help you secure all your IoT devices. So.
But it also goes back to last night. We were talking about triage. I believe that we've done triage in the home market, and it's been abandoned by and large. I believe that we've done triage, and it's going to be abandoned in IoT. And I think a lot of the people that are out there trying to solve the IoT problem are pretty much snake oil salesmen, by and large, unless it's like a vulnerability management. And that's, once again, an enterprise-level product, right? You want to find your SCADA devices. Like, we talk about Waterfall and some of those companies. That's different. But like home IoT, no, I don't think that there's any money there. And the reason why is I can't see how someone can convince a home user to spend more than $50 a year on their AV subscription.
Right.
I agree with you. Yeah, I completely agree. I think we're in for it. But, you know, that also goes back to this is where I get excited. I want to start seeing people come to us and say, hey, I've got a different way to do it. Like, I'm tired of people telling me the only solution to phishing is we got to go teach people how to recognize phishing. Security people get routinely fooled by it at the same or higher numbers than the rest of the base of users in an organization. So as a result of that, I'm just still trying to understand why technology-wise we're not able to do better with it, and I think we've got our opportunities there. But this is great. John, I hope you can join us more often. This is fun.
I'd like to.
This was a lot of fun. Good. You want to do our journeys real quick, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I was talking – can't remember anymore if we're online or offline. A big lesson I learned this week was simple starts – have good play, and what I finally figured out was the opposite of straight talk is being stuck. And when you get stuck, largely because of friction, that's when you erode your value. So most of us have been around security projects that get stuck, and we had a line item anywhere from $100,000 to $2 million, and it's just sitting there because we can't use it because I can't get anything going. It turns out that that's a pretty common problem. And so I still have the three big ideas that I figured out. I've been talking to people for the last week, and I am getting really excited because I think we've started to figure out how to get people unstuck and get some of these good projects flowing. And it's fascinating. Back to our conversation, we're talking about value, and we're talking about readiness and measurement and how it works with communication. And John, you'll appreciate one of the things I always ask them is, does this work in the environment we have? I don't mean how are you going to communicate. Does this work with the tools we have? If not, we should talk about that. So yep. It's good. Like I'm, you guys know this, it's a roller coaster. I'm kind of liking the downhill I'm on right now. It's woo, fun.
What are we doing? We got an open source tool that's
Rita,
rocking.
Yeah, Rita's version 1 in 2 weeks.
I think we're still trying to figure out what we give away for free versus what we charge people for. That's still an ongoing conversation. It's a very difficult conversation to have. John and I, being in the security community for so long, we're like, yeah, we want to give people like more. And then we're like, but then
I think personally for me, I would be happy to give it all away for free, but I also have to feed my family.
And, it's true.
Funny how that works.
And yours, right? Yep. Which we got to do. So there's going to be that balance. But the thing that's cool is the community of people that we have will understand. Mm. And I think that that's going to be awesome. We're going to give them something that's going to be cool. It's going to give them a lot of value. And we're going to sell something that's going to up that. It's going to be that little like mushroom that's going to make them trip out and grow bigger, I suppose.
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily saving time, right? I think it's making people more efficient and effective at their
it's
jobs.
The power up. It's the power up, and I think that that's a good thing. I almost am exhausted. It's been a year of this, and it's been a really incredibly rough year for a number of different reasons. Yeah. And a whole bunch of things took longer for a number of different reasons, but I think that we learned that that's to be expected. You better be ready for that. But I finally feel like we're at that point. Like, Mike, you said that you're on kind of a downhill. I'm ready to be on a little bit of a downhill for a little bit. And I think that we're damn close to getting to that. As far as like BHIS and Security Weekly, when did you leave Tenable? When was that?
February of last year, so about a year.
February of last year.
About a year.
And think about the year, like BHIS growing, the year Security Weekly. I mean, Security Weekly is now juggernaut, right? And that's cool.
Yeah, we got 5 shows now.
Yeah, in a lot of ways it was a really, really rough year, but in a lot of ways it was a fantastic year. And it's just a matter of stabilizing, leveraging, and I think we achieved all of the goals that you and I set out in February whenever you left Tenable. And I think that that's a very cool thing.
Awesome. Michael, I know you got to run, so thank you everyone for watching Startup Security Weekly, and we'll see you next week.
Woo!